Hello and welcome to another special Monday edition of The Price of Football, the podcast that follows the money behind the beautiful game. I'm Kevin Day, and as ever, I'm joined by Baron, the Professor of Football Finance Expert, Kieran Maguire. Hello, Kieran.
Hello, Kevin.
We're going to have to stop calling it a special pod because it's become, this is four or five in with now. This is not special anymore.
It's just part of ingrown English culture now.
Almost. We're getting there. If you leave enough good reviews, people, we will become part of ingrown English culture.
Well, my Twitter account has just been acquired by the British Library as part of English culture. They wrote to me and said, we think it represents part of the fabric of modern society, and would you agree to it going into the British Library archive? We are there.
I've got some bad news for you, Kieran. That was me. That's fantastic. That's really good. I'm furious that I've not been asked. That's great, though. So they'll record your pod, your Twitter feed, and it. Well, everybody at home starts sending him racy tweets. She was a good actress, wasn't she? Racy tweets.
Oh yeah, all around.
The first question is from Kieran Mitchell. Now, there's been talk of QSI, the Qataris Sport Investment Company, who own PSG pretty much. A lot of talk about them investing into Leeds. All right. Now, if Leeds were to get promoted, Kieran's question is, where would that? If QSI bought them, where would that rank them in the sort of league table of Premier League investors? And this is a subject we have mentioned before, but in the Premier League, are investors allowed to be involved in more than one club? We know they're not in the AFL technically. They can be if they're, you know, in different countries, but are the Premier League rules different?
Premier League rules are the same, because otherwise you could end up with a match at the end of the season where one club could potentially be relegated, and you could have an inappropriate result as a result of that.
But Leeds in the Premier League owned by QSI would be huge, wouldn't it?
In terms of the wealth of QSI, certainly they are. They are on a par with the Abu Dhabi United Group, who own Manchester City, on a par with Abramovich and so on. It then comes to the issue of what approach do they take in respect of financial fair play. And the Premier League have been a bit coy and a bit vague as to the nature of the penalties. I'm aware of one Premier League club where there is an owner behind the owner, potentially, who is taking the view of, I don't care what it costs for this club to progress to the next level. And if we get fined, so be it, we'll just pay the fines.
Which is, we've talked about Bet365 wanted to take that approach with Stoke, haven't we, as well?
That's right. Now, in the EFL, if there is a breach of financial fair play, one of the sanctions that the EFL have within their armoury is a points deduction. So that could act as a big deterrent for Stoke City. We're not sure what the position is being taken by the Premier League itself. So if it's a fine, you could find QSI come in, they say to whoever the manager is, you've effectively got a blank check, in the same way that Roman Abramovich said to Jose Mourinho when he first came to the club, sign whoever you want and we'll take that. And Manchester City did exactly the same.
But surely QSI, would they not at least publicly pay lip service to the idea of financial fair play and then do what other clubs have done and find a way around it? Because it would seem quite ballsy just to come in and say, you do what you want, we'll pay the fine and we'll carry on with this uneven playing field.
Well, I'm sure if there is a creative accounting scheme around it, they will employ the appropriate advisors to come up with such a vehicle. But Leeds fans won't be complaining. And ultimately, if the Leeds fans are happy, then the owners are happy.
Have QSI been sniffing around a Premier League club before?
Nothing's been concrete. The trouble with all of these rumours, it's the same way as that we deal with transfers. You know, somebody posts something somewhere, and then it becomes a story in one of the newspapers. So I'm always cautious to a degree. If you take a look at the ownership of Leeds United Football Club, they're now owned 10% by the San Francisco 49ers. So would they be willing to give up their shares?
Right, okay.
So who's selling the shares to whom? And also at what price?
Right. The next question is from Salman Ali, who tells us it's a fantastic pod, which is the way to get a question asked. Everybody tells us it's a fantastic pod. Thank you, but I only read the odd one out. despite the producer pleading with me to read them all. Now, there was a documentary about Salford City recently on the television. He said it raised a few eyebrows, which is good to see. It's not just mine getting up. Basically, his question is, how are they getting past... see, he didn't... The raising voice is mine, not Salmon's. How are they getting past FFP rules? And how much have the owners put in? Obviously, the class of 92 are the main owners. And presumably, why would they put it in when they're never going to see that money back again, are they?
Well,
apologies, by the way, if you can hear coughing. That's the young lady who's staying with us who's not very well at the moment. And we don't have any doors in our house.
In terms of FFP, Salford have come from the National League.
Well, I've been researching Salford for this and for another project again. They're essentially, it's an amazing story. They're a glorified Sunday League team, essentially. It's not that long ago when they were an amateur team, and now here they are in the Football League.
Yeah, and I think there's two narratives here. Certainly the documentaries we've seen in linking them with the class of 92, Peter Lim, who is the other investor. Yeah. So I think we've got the five footballers and this overseas investor. I think he's from Singapore. Yeah. He's the person that's putting in all the money. The shareholders will have bought the shares for a nominal amount. He's put in all the cash. Salford City were losing $35,000 a week in National League North. Now that's two tiers below where they are at present. So they've not yet published their accounts for last season when they were promoted from the National League. I think there will be a lot of people curious as to A, what were the losses, and B, will Gary Neville actually produce a full set of accounts so that idiots like me can go through and truly look at the numbers?
It's precisely because he knows people like you are going to look through the numbers. He doesn't want to produce the accounts, possibly.
Yeah, I fully understand that.
Yeah.
In terms of what's happened this season, it looks like they've put in a further $2.5 million has been lent to the club or has been created for the shareholders. So they are, I would expect them to have one of the biggest wage bills in League Two, but whether we'll find out those actual numbers is another matter.
Okay. This question is from Paul, just Paul. It's an interesting question. He's talking about Man United apparently not buying Erling Haaland because of clauses relating to future knock-on transfer fees and how much of that money would go to the agent and the father. Now, he's a West Ham fan, a long-suffering West Ham fan, he describes himself as. He basically says, is that not akin to third-party ownership? And as a West Ham fan, he of all people should know that technically that's not allowed, is it?
Well, certainly. Third-party ownership isn't allowed within UEFA. It used to be very common in South America.
Yes, yes.
Because it allowed agents and investors to go in and effectively pay for the player's education to fund the club itself, and then if the player turned out to be successful, they got a share of that.
What are the clauses in this contract that apparently put them off buying Haaland?
Well, I think it's relation to sell-on fees,
yeah,
and also contract renewal fees. Now we saw with the if he'd signed a four-year contract and he turns out to be as good as people think he is, after 2 years, United would have gone to him and say, well, we're going to offer you a big pay rise to sign for another 5 years. From what this appears to indicate, that they would be committing to pay the agent and the father, who could be the agent for all I know.
We don't know if they're not separate people.
I'm not sure
right,
on this
okay,
one.
Okay.
To give them a large sum of money. But that would be fairly standard. Every time a player renegotiates a contract, it won't be the player himself involved in the negotiations. It would have been his agent. And therefore, the agent would take their standard commission, but also if there is an additional fee for the actual signing of the contract, they would have taken a proportion of that, as we saw with the signing of Paul Pogba from Juventus to Manchester United, where the agent took $26 million, and that agent has just taken on Jesse Lingard onto his books.
Right. Is your instinct that there are other deals that don't get done because of clauses like this, or is this a one-off, do you think, or a two-off?
If the club wants the player that much, the deal will take place.
Right. Okay.
So I think this is one of many players that Manchester United have been linked with, as is always the case at this time of year. And it could be that it's a story which has been put out by somebody to try to dampen down the expectations of United fans by saying, look, we're Manchester United. We take a moral high ground on this because they don't want to be involved with Crayola, for example. And therefore, we're not interested in this player. But if they really wanted him, they'd go for it.
Now you, Professor Barron, are going to love these next two questions because they are quite technical. I, on the other hand, will probably go and make a cup of tea.
Very wise.
Because the questions, they're not baffling. They come from, and I really, really apologise in advance if I'm not pronouncing this properly. They come from Shingirirai Chuma. Thank you for the questions. The first one is, and genuinely, your eyes are lighting up because I can see you probably know which questions are being asked here. You've got spreadsheet eyes, haven't you?
Oh, I have.
Now, is there a consistency, he says, amongst Premier League clubs in the classification of expenses in the profit and loss columns? And can you, as he suspects, hide losses away as, say, admin expenses?
There is no agreed classification. Okay. The Premier League encourages clubs to split their income between broadcasting, match day and commercial. Okay. And nearly all of them do that. When it comes to costs, they are legally obliged to show wages. So therefore they have to do that. They are legally obliged to show directors' wages separately.
Okay.
But this makes life quite complicated. You don't have to do that if you're a company based in the States. So when Manchester United published their results in September, you didn't find out Ed Woodward's wages, but they did publish another company in the Manchester United's result, in the Manchester United Group's wages on Friday. So being a nosy little shit, I went into those.
Term, yes, yes.
And I think he's on about three. I think he's on 3.2 million. From Manchester United last year. So he had a £1 million pay cut, presumably because they didn't qualify for the Champions League.
So this idea of hiding losses as admin expenses, say, which, I mean, it's probably what you'd call cooking the books in the old days, isn't it? Is disguising stuff, which I imagine many companies would do, wouldn't they? Just that everyone makes their books look better than they are, or
yeah,
worse.
But
if you're trying to avoid tax, worse, maybe.
I think that some disastrous transactions can be hidden. So, well, whilst we have spoken about clubs such as Chelsea, they have said that they paid Conte £26 million in compensation. Only two or three clubs in the Premier League have said what they've paid to managers for sacking them. Now, other clubs haven't. So, again, some things can be hidden. It comes down to the integrity of the people publish the accounts, and you've got to give credit to United and Chelsea and Everton and Liverpool that they've tended to go forward and give these descriptions when they've taken place. Other clubs will say, well, oh, we made a loss last year because we sacked the manager. Well, if you made a loss of 30 million quid, you know, did it cost you 3 million? Did it cost you 5 million? Did it cost you 10 million? Don't give us half a story. Be completely transparent, in my view.
Now, the second part of Shingirire's question, and again, I do apologise if I've not pronounced that properly, but feel free to tweet me with the carefully phonetically spelt pronunciation. And this is an interesting question, actually. Basically, the question is, do the football authorities have minimum disclosure requirements for financial statements when they're submitted to Companies House?
Well, the simple answer is no.
No.
They can put out, provided it agrees with the law, then they're fine to do that. And if you are a club below a certain size, you don't have to publish anything to do with your profit and loss account, not the wages, you don't know how much income the club is making and so on. And the argument that comes from the Footballers Supporters Association, and I'm been banging on about this as well, is that a football club, it isn't the same as your local washing machine manufacturer. And as fans, you know, we are investors, we are stakeholders, whatever you want to call it, and I want to know just how well the club is doing because it's my club.
Yeah.
And what the clubs can get away with showing to Companies House is practically worthless. And that's what we're seeing a lot of the time in League One and League Two. And then you end up with another Macclesfield, another Bury, and so on. And the fans are going, well, we didn't notice anything. Well, because there was nothing to see in the first place.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
Well, it's interesting. I suppose, from my point of view, and it's the reason I was asked to do this pod, because I have no business brain whatsoever, and football finance was a mystery to me, and Guy thought it would be hilarious to pair us up in a kind of odd couple police drama type situation. But if Palace, for example, were to publish, you know, detailed accounts, I wouldn't be able to pick up on whether or not they were good or potentially... And there aren't that many people like you who can do that job, so would it have an effect? I mean, and because I absolutely agree with the FSA. I mean, I think there should be far more transparency than there is, but clubs have got people who are clever enough to disguise potential problems, and they don't necessarily want fans to realise that there are issues, and they certainly don't want potential investors to realise these things, do they?
Well, I mean, the accounts will be audited, so therefore, in theory, somebody will have taken a look at them to make sure that there is nothing nefarious taking place in terms of the way they're being classified.
But those auditors, if losses are made, it's not the auditor's job to make that public, is it? If something nefarious has happened, of course they would do, but if it's just a club unexpectedly losing money, they wouldn't tell us that, would they?
Well, I can work out the losses for every club.
You can, of course.
But I can't work out how they made those losses.
Right.
If the club is below a certain size.
Right.
My view, and I'm not the only person that does this. I mean, there is the guy who I call the governor. There's a guy based in Switzerland who's been doing this for years.
You call him the governor. He must be good.
Oh, yeah. I'm the Andrew Ridgeley to his George Michael in the Wham! Wow. Of football finance.
We need to find out about this mysterious fella, don't we? My word. Does he social media? Has he got?
He's the Swiss Rambler. Yeah.
Oh, him.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh,
yeah. Oh, yeah. He is the governor.
He's actually Swiss.
He's relocated. His wife's Swiss.
Do you know what? I'm aware of the work of the Swiss Rambler. I always assumed there was some hilarious reason behind the name.
No. He lives in Switzerland and he likes rambling. Walking.
Okay, fine. So, yes, his work is...
So his work is the gold standard as far as I'm concerned.
Wow.
There's we're not all idiots as football fans, as the club owners like to make out. Now,
I implied 5 minutes ago, yes.
And I would imagine for a significant proportion of football fans, you go along, you meet up with your mates, you have a few pints, you watch the match, you shout rude things at rude people, and you go home. And it's a form of escapism. And I fully understand that not everybody wants to know about the money side of things, because I don't give a hoot about the money made. If I go to watch 1917 this week, I don't care whether it made money or not. You know, was it a good film?
Yeah,
or was it a good football match? Or was it a good gig?
Yeah.
So, but if it affects the future of the club in terms of survival or being acquired by a mysterious foreign investor, I think I am entitled to a little bit more information and a little bit more knowledge. You mentioned people taking over clubs. They will go through the books with a fine-tooth comb, because that's due diligence. It's the equivalent of you buying a house. What do? You get a surveyor to go in, and they're the professionals, and you rely upon their opinion.
Did I mention my house hasn't got any doors?
I
believe I mentioned that in passing, didn't I? So that's an indication, isn't it? The final question, it comes from James Audley. Thank you for your question, James. It's probably hypothetical, but I think it's a very good question. We talked about the proposed changes to the Champions League recently. And James's question is, would a British league work financially? Would broadcasters and fans like it? Would it kill off smaller teams? And we're talking, if I spend a lot of time in Scotland during the Edinburgh Festival. I love Scotland. Interested in its history and its culture and its football. And of course, fans of clubs like Aberdeen, Hibs, Hearts will say, well, if you're going to have a British league, it shouldn't just be Celtic and Rangers. We should be involved as well. And part of you inside thinks, well, good luck to that, because it's only really Celtic and Rangers that would ever, I think, become part of a a British league, I'm assuming. But I mean, how logical is it? Because it's one of those things, is that every 5 years somebody says, come along, well, let's get Celtic and Rangers into the Premier League, although whether they would survive there is a different question. But is this something that you think could happen? And what would it do to smaller clubs either side of the border if it did?
If the Champions League expanded Super League takes place and the likes of Liverpool and Manchester United disappear out of the Premier League, yeah, I think it could work, because all of a sudden, filling that vacuum, you've got West Ham, Everton, Newcastle, Glasgow Celtic, Glasgow Rangers. Yeah. And if you've got 20 teams in that league, well, there's no reason why Aberdeen or Hearts or Hibs couldn't be there, for the same reason that we presently have Burnley and Bournemouth, who are, you know, relatively small towns. You know, Bournemouth's only got a capacity of 11,000, as we previously discussed. Burnley's got a capacity of 20. Watford's got a capacity just over 20. Well, if those clubs can be members of the Premier League and survive there, then why can't Scottish clubs join in? I think it would certainly increase the interest. There would be a lot of, you know, go off and do your own business to the Premier League clubs, but it ain't going to happen, because I think the changes, when they do come about, or if they come about, Liverpool fans still want to play Manchester United every season, yeah, twice, and that wouldn't necessarily work in one of these expanded Champions League formats.
Yeah.
What my understanding is that owners want more fixtures which are lucrative. So therefore they want a smaller Premier League of 16 to 18 clubs. So therefore you get rid of Bournemouth, Watford, Brighton, Huddersfield, yeah, you know, all of, yeah, those clubs.
Well done for saving me saying Brighton.
Well, I thought I'd preempt you. Because they don't bring... They don't bring the money in, and then it purely becomes a glorified form of American sport and franchise. So you get a 16 to 18 club Premier League
with no relegation. You're implying?
I think relegation. I think that would be the one thing they would fail,
right,
to get through,
right?
Because there has to be a cut off point. So any club which says, "Well, I can see us going down this season, but at least we've got the prospect of coming back up." And also, I think it is so much part of our culture in Europe. Yeah, we're not American. We don't see our football clubs as franchises.
No,
we do start every August with the romantic notion, well, we could get into the Europa League. We could have a good cup run this season, and that would be destroyed if there was no relegation.
In terms of the impact on smaller clubs, smaller English clubs, I can't imagine would be impacted that much. But in Scotland, when you talk to Scottish football fans, there are two schools of thought. Most, I would say 60-70% of Scottish football fans say that without Rangers and Celtic, a lot of clubs would go to the wall. But there are Scottish football fans who say that the Scottish football then become much more competitive, and that it might actually attract more people, and then, you know, the sectarian nature of Scottish sport, which unfortunately still exists, would be taken away, and that might encourage new people to come along. So what would your take on that be?
Football clubs lose money because they pay wages that they can't afford.
Right.
Now, if you take Rangers and Celtic out of Scottish football, all that would happen is that within 2 years, the players who are on £3,000 a week at some clubs would be on £1,500 a week, because, right, the clubs would have turned around to the players and the agents and say, look, you've got two choices. You can either accept the lower offer, or the club goes out of business.
Yeah, right.
What would you rather have? So I think we would still have some form of Scottish football. Already in the lower leagues, it is effectively a glorified amateur sport. You know, they're not on full-time contracts in league, you know, Scottish League Division 2 and 3. And I think it would be great at some point if we have a full Scottish episode.
We are planning that full Scottish episode.
Cool. And the same would be the case in England. The likes of Forest and Derby and Leeds, to a certain extent, they would fill the vacuum if the Big Six decide to go off and form their own special little gang and play against Bayern and Real Madrid and Atletico and Barcelona and so on every week.
Well, just quickly, I mean, one of the smaller clubs in the Scottish Premier League, because we know outside, you know, you've got Celtic and Rangers who are getting 60,000-70,000 people a week. You've got Aberdeen probably getting 15,000-16,000. Hearts, Hibs, that's 10,000-12,000. But there are other clubs in Scotland, Hamilton, Inverness. You're looking at 3,000 people. So
yep.
If you're a club that size in the Premier League and you take away Rangers and Celtic, how drastically does that impact their finances? Because I'm guessing that a lot of the money would come from the travelling support. They play each other four times a year, don't they? So
they do, but remember they all survived without Rangers in the Scottish Premiership for 5 years.
Yeah, fair point.
If you were in the bottom six, you only played Celtic once because of the way that the league was split. And I think some of those clubs say, well, actually, when those clubs come to town, lots of our local fans, they don't go to the match because of the rather aggressive behaviour of some of those groups. So I don't think they'd be too worried about it.
Okay.
If I've got the wages or my estimated wages for the clubs. And in Scottish football, you've got some clubs in the top division who are on less than £1,000 a week. So
Okay.
There's not a lot of money to cut there. If you think about any other business, you are not reliant upon one day's income for 3 hours being the make or be all of your annual finances. So, and the same applies to Scottish football.
And are there still noises coming from Celtic and Rangers that they need to be in a different league to compete in Europe?
I think Steven Gerrard said something of this nature in the last couple of weeks. But let's take a look at all of the people involved in making this decision. As far as the Premier League are concerned, do the big six clubs want further competition coming from Rangers and Celtic? Well, no, they don't, because there's only four Champions League places. Do the other 14 clubs want Celtic and Rangers in the Premier League? Well, no, because they're taking two of our places.
Yes.
So there's no desire for it south of the border. The clubs are making enough money from TV that they don't need a couple of visits a year from Scottish teams, because most away allocations are sold out. The Premier League, in terms of match day attendance, is still spectacularly successful.
We are, Scottish listeners, I promise you, we are planning that Scottish special, because we're trying to get somebody very high profile from the Scottish FA to be a guest and join us. So we will look forward to that, and we look forward to joining you again on Thursday. This is Monday, yes. It gets confusing, doesn't it? Yeah, we look forward to joining you again on Thursday. Thank you for listening. Thank you for your questions. Keep them coming. questions@priceoffootball.com. The Price of Football is a Dap Dip production. Please leave reviews where you leave reviews. Make them good ones. And we'll see you soon. Take care.
Cheerio, folks.
The Price of Football. Price of Football.